Hi, everyone. Welcome. This is Andy Smerik, your host of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Thanks for being with us. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the head of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, Checker Finn. Welcome.
It's always a pleasure. Glad to see you again.
No, this is a lot of fun. We have these rotating chairs, sometimes Mike, sometimes Rick, sometimes me, sometimes Stafford.
If my chair rotates, I may fall off.
Well, thank you for joining us. It's going to be a lot of fun. So actually, let's just kick off and get right into things. We have a great schedule here. We have Mickey first. We're going to do Pardon the Gadfly with him. Then, of course, Amber's Research Minute. And then we're going to close off with Stafford and Rate That Reform. So let's just get going with question number one. Mickey.
Leading philanthropist Don Fisher lost his battle with cancer this week. In the education world, he'll be remembered as the biggest philanthropic champion of KIPP, which he helped grow from a single school to an impressive network of 82 schools across the country. Without Don Fisher, where do you think KIPP would be today? Would other philanthropies eventually have picked it up, or would it still be a single school in Houston?
Don Fisher was a great man, and actually, if you read today's Gadfly, you'll see more about Don Fisher based on his extraordinary career in education and in philanthropy. KIPP is his best-known legacy, and the 82 schools there and the plan to grow them further owe a great deal to both Don's very generous checkbook and Don's vision of how a school could become somewhat like The Gap. You could replicate a good thing and then replicate it again.
Yeah, I completely agree with this. And I think nowadays, I mean, we're in 2009 and we kind of take it for granted that they're the achievement first and there's the uncommon schools and that we like this idea of replication and there are models of education. But back in 2000 when this got started, Aspire was the only other network and they really got started in 1999, 2000. So it was really.
And they were only in California.
Exactly. And so it was Don Fisher, a guy who had replicated the Gap model, who actually said to these two young, crazy guys running these two schools, hey, why don't we figure out what you're doing in two discrete locations and see if we can figure out how to do this in 5 or 10 or 20 locations. Lo and behold, tens of thousands of kids across the nation are getting served every day. It's a genius and it actually has worked out.
And we're evolving brand name schools in America, and the KIPP brand happens to be a good one.
No doubt. There's actually a good article a couple issues back in Education Next on brand name charters that sort of goes through this, so take a look at that. And the other thing we should also mention is Don Fisher not only invested in KIPP, he also invested in Teach for America, invested in the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, and some of the state-based organizations. So he's actually, his footprint is large, and he'll be missed.
And in a few projects and studies of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, for which we're very grateful to him and his wife Doris, his partner in all matters.
Indeed. So rest in peace. He did some great work. Issue number two. Thank you, Mickey.
Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan offered his first remarks on the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind recently at an event last week for education stakeholders. What do you gather he's picked up from his listening and learning tour, and where do you see the NCLB debate headed?
This listening tour is going to go on and on and on. And in addition to stakeholders, we're going to have vegetable holders and we're going to have cheese holders and you name it. Secretary Duncan, I think, finally got a little sheepish about not having mentioned the phrase No Child Left Behind for 8 months. So now he's mentioned it. He said he's going to do something about it, and he's listening to people tell him what to do about it, though he actually did say one very important thing, which is that he is not rejecting the fundamental standards and accountability model that is incorporated in No Child Left Behind. He's going to refine it, he's going to fix it, he's going to repair it, but he did not say this was a bad idea and it should be thrown out. He did not say that. I think we're going to have the son of No Child Left Behind around at some point in the Obama-Duncan administration.
Well, I can't add too much to that other than saying I think he defined the term damn with faint praise in the way he talked about No Child Left Behind. He said some things like, well, you know, it kind of moved us in the right direction when it came to disaggregation of data and so forth. And then he ticked off a bunch of things that it went wrong in different areas. The other thing I think that we just have to point out here is he dedicated 50% of this speech to one of my favorite parts of the civil rights legacy, which is the letter from the Birmingham jail that Martin Luther King wrote in response to an open letter. And the thrust of that is justice delayed is justice denied, the urgency of now, that we can no longer wait. We have to act right now to get civil rights and social justice. So his entire speech was based on we must act now to get NCLB reauthorized. And then he goes and says, we're going to continue the listening and learning tour for another couple months and not have any agenda, not have any timeline, not have any proposal, but we're going to listen some more.
Reauthorization delayed is reauthorization denied.
Really something else. But to their credit, they've been working on ARRA and Race to the Top and so forth. I think they had limited bandwidth. Now they're going to move on to NCLB reauthorization eventually. So
eventually.
Good luck. Godspeed to them. Issue 3.
Seton Education Partners has just published a study written by none other than Andy Smerick on the conversion of 7 Catholic schools in the D.C. area to charter schools. The Catholic to charter idea seems to be catching on. What do you think of it?
Well, Andy periodically backs into a good idea.
I'm talking about damning by faint praise. That's awesome.
It's praising with faint dams, actually. This was a good piece of work, and it's a very important idea. And it's an idea that I think is going to rock both the private school world and the charter world in the years ahead. Which is how do we take some of America's literally tens of thousands of private schools, many of them religious, many of them running out of money and clients, and convert them into a quasi-public school without losing the essence of what made them worth having in the first place. And the charter conversion idea from private schools, though it's forbidden in some states, is going to be a very hot topic in the months and years ahead.
Well, what's interesting here, and I don't mean to date Checker by saying this, but back in his early days in the government...
You mean back around Jefferson's time.
A little after that, Madison Monroe. He actually, his White House, working for the Nixon administration, they were worried about Catholic schools, faith-based schools, and this has gone on for decades and decades and decades. And here we have finally a mechanism that folks up in Minnesota came up with, chartering, that no one in the early days would have guessed that chartering would be used to fix these schools. So it just shows that there's this secondary unintended consequences of public policy. So it might be the case that chartering, something that liberals in Minnesota came up with to help teachers start their own schools, might actually be the mechanism used to somehow salvage, keep open a bunch of faith-based schools in urban areas that are serving poor kids well, which is actually fascinating public policy-wise.
You could say it's the domestic equivalent of Nixon goes to China.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think everyone who is kind of looking at this issue has to realize that this is not plug and play. This is not the kind of thing that is automatically going to happen easily, the conversion of these schools. The case study actually makes the case that were not for the heroic leadership of Marianne Stanton, had it not been for the mechanism of the Catholic school.
Okay. There's a lot of praise to go around, not just to you, Andy, but thank you for a nice piece of work.
Let's move on. So actually, we're going to move on to Amber, Research Minute. So this is where we dance to Amber's song. I wish everyone out there in TV land could see Checker dancing. Amber, how are you?
I'm doing great. Just doing great.
So I have to channel Mike and look at my watch and make
sure
that you don't hit 60 seconds.
I know I've gone over this week, so I'll try to, you know, speed it up, but it's going to be a little long.
All right.
So this week we have a new study out by researchers at the Brookings Institution that examines the economic cost of school closures in the U.S. based on a swine flu pandemic. Serious stuff. The CDC, of course, reports that the swine flu virus is now widespread throughout the U.S., and many school officials have already closed school doors around the country. In fact, 42 schools closed in 8 states last week, which affected roughly 16,000 students. So researchers have calculated the economic cost of closing all schools in the U.S. for 4 weeks due to a moderate pandemic flu outbreak. 4 weeks is the CDC's recommendation should the pandemic hit a moderate severity level. The study uses a household-based labor force survey to estimate closure costs via adults' actual wages and various other representative surveys to estimate adults' ability to work at home. Researchers find that closing schools for 4 weeks would reduce our GDP by between $10 and $47 billion, not exactly precise there, mean that 12% of the workforce will be absent and lead to the absence of up to 19% of relevant healthcare personnel just when they're needed because many of them will be home with their children. That's not including the learning loss that will occur, which researchers compared to losses over summer break. Granted, closing all schools in the U.S. for a month seems like a worst-case scenario, but nonetheless, we do need data to illustrate the potential impact on schools and the economy of the swine flu. How long?
72 seconds.
72 seconds. All right.
Not too bad.
Those
work.
Swine at Brookings.
So, Checker, actually, let's take a step back from this. Is there, in your time in education, are there any parallels to this? Something where we actually were talking about shutting down schools for a month because of a possible pandemic? I don't even know how to put this in context.
No, this is all unprecedented. I really don't think it's going to happen. I think that people are panicking unnecessarily, both about swine flu and about its implications for schools. Furthermore, this dollar cost could have just as easily been calculated, I think, by taking the annual budget of American schools and dividing by 9 equal to 1 month of the year and figuring out what that might cost. Mm-hmm. I assume they are planning in this study, they are estimating that those days will be made up at the end of the year and that a fair chunk of the cost is the cost of bringing those kids and teachers back to school for makeup weeks at the end of the year.
I didn't read anything about that.
Well, then they're just giving everybody a month off.
Right.
And America's children are going to be jubilant, and America's parents are going to be devastated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't even know what to say about this. I mean,
go get your shot and hush up.
Yeah, I mean, we've had chickenpox, we've had mumps, we've had measles. It's not the first time there's been a potential of kids getting sick.
Yeah. Well, then they try to break out costs about what it would cost D.C. and L.A., and so there are some, you know, I don't know.
Much
ado about not so much. Go back to something important, Brookings.
Ooh, wow. On that note.
Bada bing. It gets better, though. Guess what the song is this week?
Do tell.
Woohoo. Well, I figured Checker might appreciate this. It's a little bit of a stretch, but since we're talking about bodies and viruses and everything, I've got Frank Sinatra's with I've Got You Under My Skin.
Mm.
What a great
subcutaneous
song. I've got you.
Yeah, this is noticeably less hip than the things that you and Laura typically pick.
Oh, but come
on. I like
on,
this, though.
This is classic. Great stuff.
It's almost intravenous.
The listener should know that was it Neo who was the second choice?
So he almost had rap, so be grateful.
I am. Thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you, Amber. So now we're going to have Rate That Reform with none other than Stafford. Stafford, come on in. People can see the grimace on poor Checker's face right now. He looks like he just got a swine flu.
Checker,
I guess he did like that one.
Checker, the song is supposed to be peppy. It's supposed to keep our listeners, you know, pepped up at the end of the...
Peppy? It's a serious work day.
No fun. So what do you have for us, Stafford?
Well, three cheers for investigative journalism. If you remember, last week I reported that there was a former assistant principal, now occupant of one of New York City's rubber rooms, who's collecting her $100,000 salary and running a side business selling children's CDs during her rubber room, quote-unquote, work day. The double dipper, Raquel Downing, has now been served with a list of open jobs in the New York City school system, forcing her to earn her keep at last. According to the DOE official who gave her the list, Ms. Downing threw a temper tantrum at being discovered and threw the list back at the official. Sounds like Ms. Downing doesn't have a choice, though, and will be forced to do actual work for her taxpayer salary. To the NY Post who discovered the story, I say congratulations. You get an A for seeing a problem, namely someone cheating the system and exposing them. I know that this is your job as a newspaper, after all, and you probably sold quite a few extra papers with this sensational story, but here's to filling your pages with worthwhile content. As for the New York Department of Ed, why didn't you discover this woman's rule flouting yourself? Is there really so little supervision in the rubber rooms that not only are its occupants allowed to knit and stare out the window on quote-unquote company time, but to run a side business as well? If you're going to keep these folks in the payroll on the taxpayer's dime, let's at least run this operation properly, or better yet, find them jobs and or fire them. That you finally did something about this woman, however, saves you from getting an F, but just barely. I'll give you a D.
What happens to the rubber room when there's a swine flu epidemic?
Oh. Very good question.
Yeah, we should cost that out, see what it would cost us or save us if all those people weren't allowed to come in or didn't get their salaries. Unbelievable. So how much worse do things have to get with the rubber room before they finally go away? I mean, does someone have to go in there and, I don't know, it's just ridiculous how far this has gotten. How many more examples do we need before we say, as public policy, this is mindless, we have to change this?
Particularly at a time of economic stringency when the most obvious thing to save on in the public fisc is the salaries of people who aren't working.
You would think.
You would think.
Unbelievable. But there we have it.
There you have it.
Yeah. You have any final thoughts about this?
if they'd all start a private business, then maybe they could lose their government salaries and not notice.
Yeah, well, I mean, this woman was, she was pissed that she was getting a job.
Right.
Think about the irony of that. She wanted to refuse a job offer. She was like, I would rather not be employed and earn my salary for not being employed.
Well, who wouldn't?
And, right. Well, of course. But it's still kind of, you know, counterintuitive. And the whole point and what the union has been arguing is that these people in the rubber rooms are trying to find jobs and they're trying to get themselves out of the situation. Here's an example of this woman who is trying actively not to get herself
There's
out of the
situation.
There's
lots of people looking for jobs in America today. Perhaps they should be given the opportunity.
Indeed.
With all the things that Arnie Duncan has been hectoring districts and states about in order to get Race of the Top funds, it's been charter schools, and it's been data, and on, I've yet to hear him say anything to New York about, if you want Race of the Top funds, you got to get rid of this rubber room. This is mindless. I wonder if he's going to do that.
As I recall, there's a rubber room by another name somewhere at the Department of Education. He might not want to focus on this topic right now.
I guess he has enough...
Keep in mind that basement where the non-working people are kept all day getting their salaries at 400 Maryland Avenue Southwest.
Uh-oh. Big news broken by Checker
wow,
Finn.
Wow, I got to research this.
You go check it out.
No All comment right. from me, the former U.S. Department of Education official. I know nothing about this. All right, any final words, Stafford, before we cut it off?
Nope. Let's wrap it up.
Checker, thank
it's
you.
It's a wrap.
Thank
My
you
pleasure.
For being with us. All right, thank you, everyone, for joining us. Remember, you can read the original Education Gadfly at edexcellence.net. Until next week, I'm Andy Smerick, and Stafford and Checker, thanks for being with us.
Way to go.
Have a good week, everyone.